Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Tetonio de Cara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell, filling in for Aggie Tupou this morning. Today on the show, the US is urging governments to push Vanuatu to drop a UN motion backing a landmark climate ruling. In just a moment, you'll hear from Vanuatu's lead climate envoy, Ralph Raganvanu, about his thoughts on all of this. Also, Samoan-Australian tennis player Destiny Iava has quit the sport, citing racism and misogyny.
Even to this day, I'm still getting racist comments, DMs and everything. So, yeah, it was never ending. And even seeing my friends as well experience similar things.
And seized cocaine is being dumped into the Pacific Ocean. So what impact is that having on marine life?
We've been finding those illicit drugs consistently in a range of animals. So I think it is an issue.
Those stories and more coming up here on Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. The US government has rejected a UN draft resolution brought by Vanuatu and is urging other countries to pressure Port Vila into withdrawing its proposal. The Associated Press reports that a diplomatic cable has been sent out to US embassies and consulates around the world stating that the US government is, quote, strongly urging Vanuatu to immediately withdraw its draft resolution. The draft endorses last year's International Court of Justice advisory opinion, which ruled that failures by states to protect people from the climate crisis could be a violation of international law. Now, Vanuatu's lead climate envoy, Ralph Raganvanu, has been at the centre of this push, and he joins me on the line this morning. Mr. Raganvanu, what is your reaction to this push from the US?
Good morning. This process we're involved in now is a... It's at the center of global UN multilateral process, which is this resolution from the General Assembly that, as you recall, in 2023, it was supported by the entire General Assembly. There were no objections. It was historically the first time ever that a request for an advisory opinion to the ICJ had been submitted by the General Assembly without dissent, which means no one objected to it, including the US. And historically, that historic first ever unanimous request for an advisory opinion went to the ICJ. And as you know, in July last year, the ICJ handed down its advisory opinion, which was a landmark in terms of saying that states do have responsibilities for taking action on climate. And so it's a normal process when a General Assembly resolution has been requested, has requested an advisory opinion, and the advisory opinion is handed down. The General Assembly will then bring that advisory opinion back to the General Assembly, acknowledge it, endorse it, and create a process for perhaps actioning it or operationalizing it within the United Nations. So that's what's happening now. Vanuatu has been working on this resolution with a group of states in a core group. So we have states from other regions of the world, representing other regions of the world. For example, we have the Netherlands representing the EU. We have Barbados, Jamaica from the Caribbean region. We have Colombia from Latin America. We have Burkina Faso, Kenya, so on. We have Asian countries like Singapore, the Philippines. They've been working with us in a core group on drafting a General Assembly resolution, which would bring the ICJAO back into the UN, recognize it, endorse it. And there are some elements to actually put it into practice, how the UN will be responding. So that's what's happening. And that resolution was brought back to the full membership after being crafted by the core group last week. And then we started with the process of what you call informals, where all states engage with the text of the resolution and can make suggestions for editing it or deleting parts of it or so on. And the first informal was on Friday last week. And the second informal is actually today, Tuesday, the 17th. Hmm. And the US has made that statement as when it received the text of the resolution. We are continuing with our normal process. And we very much hope that they will engage in this normal multilateral process. And we note their concerns, but we're continuing with the inclusive consultation process to enable all states to have the equal opportunity to provide the input into the draft resolution, and we'll see what happens.
And what was your first reaction, though, when you did see the news of this cable about the US strongly urging you to withdraw this draft resolution?
Well, it was a bit of deja vu, really, because I was in London for the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, vote on the greenhouse gas levy for international shipping back in October last year, which would have been the first ever industry-wide, legally binding greenhouse gas levy ever. And earlier in the year, last year, we'd had a very strong vote in favor of bringing that forward. And then when we got to the IMO in London in October, the US did exactly this. They did a demarche to all countries not to support it. And in the end, it resulted in the whole measure being delayed for a whole year to this year. So basically, they managed to derail the progress of that levy. And so we've seen it happen before. We had they approached the capitals to say, do not support this. Although back then it was a different context. It's a different fora. This is actually the General Assembly. The General Assembly has already passed this resolution seeking this advisory opinion. So it was unfortunate, but we've seen it before, and we are proceeding to see if we can get something voted up on the General Assembly. And the date is the end of March to actually go to that vote.
Have you had any response from any other countries, whether it's pulling out or concerns? Like you say, you saw it happen with the IMO. This has only just happened, but have you heard anything from other countries so far?
At the first informal last Friday, over 90% of states turned up, and they were giving statements the whole time. And so lots of participation. We had a full room. Many commented, comments of support. Some were concerned about particular elements. And there's one element in the resolution which talks about a registry, to establish an international registry of climate change. And that's probably the most problematic or most concerning part for countries like, for example, Germany has specifically raised that is something that they find concerning. So we are taking all of this on board, and it'll probably affect how the resolution looks by the time it gets to the floor of the General Assembly. But that's the whole point of these informals, is to take on concerns, take on support. But the level of participation we've had, as I said, over 90% of states, very good.
And you have this second informal today, and like you say, you're in this sort of edit process where people can add, take things out, discuss, negotiate. If it does get accepted by the UN General Assembly, like you say, at the end of March, how significant would it be if it was to be able to be accepted and pass?
Well, in the current form, it will be really a great step forward, because it does actually address what the court called a quintessential universal risk, which is climate change. And it provides this way for states to deal with climate change, to recognize that it's affecting states, and to recognize that there is damage happening, and that there's a mechanism for repairing or reparation for climate harms, which is what the Paris Agreement talked about. So it provides a process whereby every year you revisit, and there are cumulative gains that can be made, and recognition, but people can quantify and say, this is what's happening to different countries of the world. And I think that would be a great step forward because that doesn't exist at the moment. And so it's going to be a step forward for climate action.
As you go through to this next informal and these next steps leading towards the end of March, what message do you have for the US and also other countries sort of at this moment of tension?
Well, it's so important at this stage that we empower the multilateral process, the international rules-based order, and that's what the message would be. Let's engage. When it comes to climate change, it is the quintessential issue that can only be addressed by all countries of the world working together. Groups of countries can't address it. So come into the process. There is a standard process that's been at the General Assembly for decades, a place where we try to make peace, we try to build global responses to crises in the international order. Come in, work with us. We encourage all states to stand in solidarity with us. Let's work on this resolution. We have the opportunity to amend it, to change it. Engage in the process, and let's see if we can get the best possible outcome that is of agreement to everybody.
Mr. Reganbanu, thank you very much for joining us here on Pacific Beat this morning.
Thank you.
That was Vanuatu's lead climate envoy, Ralph Reganbanu, speaking to me there. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, Samoa's new government came to power in a landslide victory last year, promising a new direction for the country. But almost 6 months after taking office, chiefs in some districts are voicing concerns over how one of its key pledges is being delivered. Adele Fruin filed this report from the capital, Apia.
During last year's election campaign, the FAST party led by Laurien Maliador Balateva Fosishmet made a number of high-profile promises. One was to give each of Samoa's 51 constituencies 2 million tala, about 1 million Australian dollars every year for development projects. But a recent change to the process has led some to speak out.
It seems things are turning bad as people are no longer united. Now disagreements have grown and some are separating into different groups.
Savai Chief Tofilau Lino from the Fa'asalele'anga No. 2 district is one leader raising concerns. He says the main issue is around the government's allocation of those funds, which critics say are being controlled by FAST party-aligned chairpersons. Previously, the funds were aligned to the regional member of parliament to distribute.
This is why there are feelings of hurt, because there is uncertainty on what to do. The leadership has changed, and now Lauli alone controls everything. We are praying for a quick solution to this problem, not just for us, but for the future and for the generations to come.
The same concerns were shared by another chief who wished to remain anonymous due to village protocols.
As for me, I'm deeply disappointed. The government has intervened by choosing the chairperson of our district committee, but our wish is that our Member of Parliament, who's already in this constituency, should have been selected. Yet we've received word that only FAST representatives will oversee matters of the district committees.
But the government is standing firm. It has also rejected allegations of alleged misallocation of funds. Speaking at a recent press conference, Samoa's Prime Minister Lauri Maliator says there have been serious allegations said about him and his government, which he says are rude and disrespectful. He says he has advised Cabinet that any district that does not support or is against the policy set out by his government will be removed from receiving the 2 million tala. This includes Savai Chief Tofilau's district, Fa'asalele'anga No. 2.
The government's decision today has stopped any further benefits for the district of Fa'asalele'anga No. 2 because it is clear they did not follow the agreement to return, give an update and resolve the matter peacefully.
He says the district of Fa'asalele'anga No. 2 was given the chance to sort out their differences in regard to the chairperson position and come up with a culturally appropriate solution. He says he has now involved law enforcement to deal with some of the allegations.
I have already handed the matter over to the police to be dealt with according to the law. All of this is being done to restrain these disrespectful behaviours that have begun to interfere with proceedings and official matters of our government.
Following the Prime Minister's decision to cut off funding for the Fasale Leanga No. 2 district, the village of Tofilau turned around and fined Tofilau with monetary and traditional offering and concluded to perform a traditional form of apology to the Prime Minister on behalf of Tofilau.
Adele Fruin reporting there.
Pacific Beat.
That's right. My name is Jordan Fennell, and you're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Tuesday morning. Now, a resident of Misima Island in Papua New Guinea is calling for better mobile network coverage in the area and mandatory GPS tracking for banana boats. Samuel Wame's call comes after a boat travelling to the island ran out of fuel and drifted for more than 700 kilometres into neighbouring Solomon Islands. Solomon's police say all six passengers are well, despite being adrift at sea for more than 3 weeks. But Mr. Wame says it's not the first time for this to happen.
This occurrence of people going missing in the sea is not an unusual thing. It's a usual thing for us. This particular group of people, especially the skipper of that banana boat, this is his second attempt to go missing in the sea. So his first encounter was in 2022, when he did the same job, drop off some people at Woodlock, and he was carrying some people back again, and then he ran short of fuel, and he drifted to Solomon Islands. So I would say honestly that this is his second encounter, but from what I think. Because he drifted once already, so he had a confidence, you know, out there in the open seas. But, you know, they made it safely.
Is there anything that authorities or the community can do to prevent these type of incidents from happening?
At this point in time, as we speak, the communication link between Woodlock and Misima, and particularly the village where I come from, we are out of network communication, and parts of Woodlock are not quite covered by communication networks. So it's hard to tell if somebody is lost out there in the sea and they're trying to alert their relatives or people. It's very hard to get them. Second to that, we could the small craft authority in Mumbai province could also make it compulsory that every small craft owner should own a perhaps something like satellite trackers. So that once they're lost out in the sea, they can ignite that satellite tracker so that the satellite can pick their whereabouts before they actually, you know, drift off into another country's borders, you know, maritime borders. They did that actually, but to certain few boat owners only, not everyone. But I would rather think that that should be made compulsory to every boat owner here. Either we pay for it or they give those trackers to us under this some kind of assistance program so they can give them to the boat owners. I personally have a boat as well. I have a 33-foot, 75 outboard motor on it, and I used it over Christmas. But my boat, you know, according to the rules of the small craft, I equipped it with tanks that can be used as life buoy or floaters. In the case of any emergencies, or I also have life jackets, but I don't have a tracker. I don't have a satellite tracker. So if it was made compulsory, I think every one of us should have, you know, have satellite trackers on our dinghy. So in the event we have any mishaps like this, we can just, you know, ignite that so the satellite can track us before we can drift off elsewhere.
What's your advice to seafarers or people looking after these boats, transporting people around? Especially at this time when you're in the cyclone season in this part of the world?
My big advice would be that every boat, small craft owner should be equipped with the basic, like one I said already, the GPS tracker if they have, or satellite tracker if they can afford one. Containers that are able to act as buoyancy when they are drifting, And I can also maybe equip it with a life jacket, which is always compulsory for any small craft, and have supply of water on board. I prefer getting 20 liters on my boat every time when I travel, and food especially. So because accidents happen and weather patterns change while you're in the course of travel, if things like that happen, at least there an extra fuel also would do, excess fuel. So that will save, you know, them from drifting. Because the recent incident happened, as per the news, is that there was cloud, the poor visibility, so they missed Mishima Island and they ran out of fuel. So if that was the case, then maybe that's why they drifted, to the people of Mishima who drifted. Thank you to the islands who found them and accommodated them, and the police who provided transport to bring them to Honiara. And the government of Solomon, thank you very much for that kind heart. And we are one people, maybe one Pacific people, and one sea. So the gesture given to us is really appreciated.
Samuel Wame from Mishima Island, speaking there to Pacific Beat's Eben Wasuka. Now, staying in PNG, because it's been identified as a country with weak measures to combat money laundering and terrorist financing after it was added to the Financial Action Task Force grey list. The task force, which sets the standard on money laundering, terrorist and proliferation financing, evaluates countries every decade. And it's not the first time PNG has found itself on this grey list, with the country first listed in 2014, and after introducing a series of legislations, it was then removed in 2016. But according to PNG politics expert Michael Kabuni, the country hasn't undertaken any major reforms to strengthen laws. He told Lucy Cooper the task force found defects in PNG's legislation relating to systems and procedures to identify and combat money laundering.
Worst case scenario, a country is placed on a blacklist, but in between blacklist and having a good and functioning anti-money laundering regimes is the grey list. So it's this middle ground. And that's where Papua New Guinea finds itself now, basically given, I think, an 18-month period to work through recommendations that are set by the Financial Agency Task Force, where Papua New Guinea has to report quarterly on progress. And if the Financial Agency Task Force, or FATF, is satisfied with the progress, then they remove Papua New Guinea from the grey list.
What specific circumstances led to PNG being grey listed this year?
Basically, a lack of compliance to anti-money laundering standards set by Financial Agency Task Force and a weak implementation or enforcement. So previously, the FATF, for Financial Agency Task Force, only had technical compliance where Papua New Guinea or any member of FATF or those who subscribe to FATF standards had to implement. But since 2013, FATF introduced what you call the effectiveness metrics. So what it means is that having laws and policies is not enough. You have to demonstrate results.
What kind of impact is this going to have in PNG?
There are all range of impacts. At the big level or macro level, it would affect, for instance, investments, because investors use the mutual evaluation report as a risk assessment document. So it helps them decide whether it is worth investing in a particular country, for instance. And this has been documented all across the world where countries placed on grey list, it affects investment. But even with, you know, Papua New Guinea borrowing internationally, it will increase the premium risk. The interest you have to pay will be raised because Papua New Guinea is a high-risk country. So investors and financiers will take that into account. But bringing things down to the grassroots level, I think the last survey was that about 90% of Papua New Guineans don't have a bank account. The way this population will be affected is that there will be high level of scrutiny placed on the banks to make sure they conduct due diligence, and that would mean having formal IDs and identifications and documents to open bank accounts. So this will make it difficult for majority of the rural population to actually be integrated into the financial system, saving bank accounts and things like that. So there are a whole host of reasons, but these are, I think, the big ones.
Could we anticipate this having an impact on PNG entering the NRL? We know that there's been talk and plans to improve the infrastructure in Port Moresby as well as the stadium. Could being grey-listed have an impact on that?
Probably two levels to that. The first one is as far as political will to get the NRL, PNG NRL team into NRL competition is there because it's driven by geopolitics and other considerations. So that will not be diluted. I think there will be strong commitment from both PNG and Australian governments to pursue the NRL project. The way it will be impacted is the transfer of funds, because with grey listing, there will be high scrutiny on funds coming in and out of Papua New Guinea. So if you wanted to get a funds, NRL funds into Papua New Guinea, there's going to be a lot of questions from the bank, delays from the bank, documentations that are required from both sides to get these funds moving. So at a very practical and technical sense, there will be implications on the funds. But as far as the, you know, will to get a team in, that's driven by a completely different consideration. It's geopolitics, in my view. So, yeah, I don't think it will be affected that much.
Michael Kabuni, Papua New Guinea politics expert and PhD student at the Australian National University, speaking there to Lucy Cooper.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions, like what happens if a World War II shipwreck ruptures and unleashes thousands of litres of oil into our ocean.
Across the Pacific, there's around 3,800 of these World War II shipwrecks, which are potentially polluting.
On Politalk, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat here on this Tuesday morning. Now, last week we reported on how the French Navy dumped more than 9 tons of cocaine into the Pacific Ocean after finding it on board a ship near French Polynesia. On social media, a number of people half jokingly asked about the impact the discarded drugs would have on marine life. But one person who can answer that is Brazilian scientist Natasha Woznik from the Federal University of Paraná. Ms. Woznik spoke with our reporter Finau Fanua, and she says there are all kinds of odd things found in fish, from cocaine to rocket fuel.
We managed detecting for the first time cocaine in Brazilian sharp-nosed sharks from Rio de Janeiro state, which is a place very urbanized, and there's a lot of pollution, and we detected and reported for the first time there. And since then, we're kind of like debating the importance of considering those pollutants in risk assessments. And then more recently, we just detected some caffeine, cocaine and painkillers in sharks from the Bahamas, which was the place I was working since 2 months ago. And it's very surprising because we always think that the Bahamas is very pristine and well-conserved, well-preserved. And we've been finding those illicit drugs consistently in a range of animals. So I think it is an issue. But of course, it's like very small concentrations. So it's not something that you will see like making the sharks go crazy and like attack people. It's not going to have the same effects on people that are under the effects of these drugs. But it's something concerning because this is coming from us, right? People are consuming these drugs or they're throwing these drugs in the ocean, and then the animals are getting in touch with these things that we still don't know the effects on them.
Fascinating. And it's not just cocaine that's being found. There's a whole range of odd things, right?
Space fuel in some sharks in Brazil. And those sharks are super close to the launch center that we have here for the Brazilian space program. And the concentrations are so crazy high that there's no other way that they were exposed to that, comparing with other places in the world, right? There's papers showing that sunscreen, it's all over sharks and rays, other types of medications. There's a super cool paper showing birth control pills and antidepressants in bull sharks, for example. So there's so many things being published right now in terms of how our habits are affecting the marine wildlife. Plastic is a huge problem, but chemical contamination is also something that is very concerning, and no one is talking about the way it should.
You say we don't fully understand what the effects are. So I guess that's where a lot of concern is.
So there's a bunch of studies on lab animals that shows that most animals that are vertebrates, which is the case for sharks and whales and dolphins and all this marine megafauna that could be exposed to those illicit drugs, showing that in fact, because we all share like a lot of genes and a lot of evolutionary history, the physiology is very well preserved. So in theory, it could have the same effects, right? But I don't think we should be concerned in terms of like how this could affect their behavior, but more how this could affect their health, because this is something they're not used to deal with in terms of their bodies being able to clear it out, their kidneys being able to just like clear out all these things. But I really don't see this as an issue in terms of their behavior, for example, not in the concentrations we are detecting.
And the obvious question is, why are traces of cocaine turning up in the blood tests of sharks? Well, according to your study, a primary suspect is law enforcement. The practice of dumping seized cocaine into the ocean, cocaine seized from drug vessels. Could you expand on this?
They just throw the bricks, as we all know. Sometimes they just use a knife to cut them out. We think that's the main way of connecting with them. But also, if we don't have a good waste management, like if the sewage is going straight to the ocean, or it's going to the fresh water and then being dumped in the ocean eventually by the estuaries or the environments that connects the fresh water with the ocean, our body metabolizes most of it, but some will be cleared out through our pee, right? So sometimes the cocaine and other drugs, because we just found like painkillers, for example, eventually it goes to the sewage and it can reach the ocean eventually. For cocaine, we think it might be the bricks, because we do see a bunch of like plastic that have the same shape being washed in the beaches there. And those are the places we found the sharks with concentrations in their blood.
Recently, the French Navy seized over 9 tons of cocaine from 2 vessels in the Pacific Ocean near French Polynesia. And they disposed all of the cargo. And yeah. Do you think that's irresponsible, dumping cocaine in the ocean to get rid of it?
I think it depends on the, of course, it's never good, right? Like the environment, no matter what we throw, it can even be like, as we just spoke about it, like caffeine. So innocent for us, just drinking coffee and taking all this like medication that have caffeine or even like energy drinks. And we don't realize that this is all going to the environment. So of course, as a professional, as someone working with pollution and the marine environment for so long, I don't think it's a good idea, of course, because first, we don't know where these things are going, right? Currents are everywhere. So if someone dumped a huge amount of drugs in the Pacific Ocean, it can just move so far and affect so many wildlife in ways that we still don't understand. As a scientist working with pollution and marine environment and animal conservation, especially for sharks and rays, I do think this could be very harmful for them, especially because we don't know, let's say, if there's like a lot of animals in that specific place, right? And they are like exposed directly to those dumping that are happening like in huge amounts. If it's affecting like juvenile animals or even pregnant females. So I do think it's very problematic. It is, and it's something that should be addressed in terms of like consulting with researchers, reading the papers and trying to come up with better solutions for that, for sure.
That was Brazilian marine scientist Natasha Woznik from the Federal University of Paraná speaking there. Australian Samoan tennis star Destiny Iava has announced her retirement from tennis in an explosive social media post, stating that 2026 would be her final year in the sport. The 25-year-old described tennis as her toxic boyfriend and said the tennis culture was misogynistic, homophobic, and hostile to anyone who doesn't fit its mold. It comes less than 3 weeks since her participation in the Australian Open, which she bowed out of in the first round. Destiny Iava spoke with the ABC's Catherine Murphy about her decision.
Yeah, growing up, my entire career, I started at five and just playing tournaments throughout that time. I experienced a lot of racism from, you know, parents, people I was playing, just comments, you know, at the back of the court. Walking through, like, kind of, it was kind of like a high school environment. So, yeah, and even to this day, I'm still getting racist comments, DMs and everything. So, yeah, it was never ending. And even seeing my friends as well experience similar things.
This breaks my heart because when I was looking into your story, I found this beautiful video of you as a 12-year-old. You were already a star, introducing yourself to the sport. And it's heartbreaking to think what was to come for that 12-year-old. What would you say to her now? Would you say maybe the path you took wasn't worth it?
Yeah, well, I would say it was a good life lesson for me to have at that age and till now as well. I feel like I learned so much from tennis just to, you know, take on the world and grow a thicker skin as well. I feel like she obviously didn't need that treatment and... Sorry, it's a bit emotional talking about it.
Take your time.
Yeah, I feel like no one kind of deserves that treatment, especially for a little girl, you know, playing a sport that's, you know, she's enjoying at the time and trying her best, and all she's focused on is, you know, doing her best, and there's constant comments that are racist or, you know, all those kinds of things. So I definitely think that from my experience, it's shaped me into the person who I am today.
You also talk about misogyny in the sport. Now, we cover tennis a lot on the show. We covered the French Open scheduling, which doesn't even allow women have a prime time spot. So we know there are major challenges. What have you experienced?
I feel like just comments made throughout, like, you know, the locker room and seeing other players' experiences as well. I feel like people saying that there's not any misogyny in this sport is just wrong. And I don't even have to say, you know, my personal experiences with it. There's so many out there of other players. And I feel like if you do think that there isn't misogyny in this sport, then you're just, you know, kidding yourself.
You've spoken up on the trolls. Despite being told, don't bring attention to them, you know, don't give them the airtime, you felt it was so important. In one part of your statement, you say the scrutiny on your body, the trolls, have damaged your relationship with your own body image. Just how deeply has that affected you?
Yeah, it goes a lot deeper. I think throughout my tennis career, I've always had issues with food, just purely based on the people around me and seeing other girls in this sport as well play tennis. I'm not really surrounded by many women like me, so it was kind of hard, and just having a bad relationship with food was really hard, and it's still something that I'm trying to work on today and just remind myself that everyone's different. And yeah, the constant comparison in this sport is crazy. It's definitely not helpful at all, but I feel like at the end of the day, it does teach you to be a lot stronger and more confident in yourself, which is something I'm still trying to work on.
Destiny Iava speaking there about her decision to quit tennis. Now, joining me to talk about all of this is the presenter of ABC's Nijin Footy and fresh off the field, Sam Wykes. Malo alele, Sam.
Malo alele, good morning.
Good morning. Sam, what was your first reaction to seeing Destiny Iava a decision to quit?
Yeah, well, I guess it was shock at first the way she did it. She's still very young, you know, in the sport. But from an understanding point of view, having interviewed her maybe, I think it was just over 12 months ago now, and following her on socials and her journey, it's just, man, the way she has that bravery and courage to like call out poor online behavior and like she would reshare posts, like I just couldn't believe people would say such horrific things like this, and she calling it out, like, to me, I was just like thinking, how does someone do that? Because I, like, you know, having played rugby in the past, a professional athlete, having rubbed shoulders with many sort of professional athletes, you know, the most common thing that everyone says is just, oh, I just turn off the comments or just ignore it, you know, put it on private, do all those things. But, you know, in the case of, say, today's day and age, it's not really social media anymore. Like, that's another level of income. It's another level of exposure to be able to elevate your game. And, you know, just seeing her, you know, not go out on her terms in a way that a sport that you're supposed to love, because in the interview that I had with her, she said, make sure you love the sport. Don't do it because your parents tell you or you're forced to do it. Just make sure you're happy and you love the sport. And to see that she's gone out this way with a bit of taste in her mouth, yeah, it breaks my heart that, she couldn't just, go out on her terms.
And when you spoke to her, about 12 months ago, when she was saying that you want to be happy and love the sport, did she also speak to you then about cyberbullying and the pressure she was under?
She was very open and honest about the challenges that she was facing as a Pacific Island athlete. And when I mean on her terms, I mean like in a positive note for her terms, like a happy way of going out. You know, when I retired, it was a happy relief type of thing. But, you know, for her, there's still this thing that where she couldn't just, go out like that. But I, when she was talking about tennis and the sport and just feeling a bit alone because there was no other Pacific Island athletes, and again, I refer to rugby union and rugby league, there's a lot of, you know, it's 50% of the playing population. So we had comfort with other players who looked like us. But for her, you know, she did feel like she was saying she was a bit alone in the sport, but trying her very best, to break that stereotype and inspire more young Pacific Island tennis players to come through.
And, how significant was it for her to be in that very prominent position, like you say, the only Pacific Islander in these big international opens? What did it mean to the Pacific Islander community for her to be up there and pushing like she was?
Oh, it's inspiring, because when you think of when you go back, I guess, to my mum or my grandparents and her bloodline, you know, someone would have had to take that first step of making that brave decision to break the mold and move for a better opportunity, you know, move to New Zealand, move to Australia, move to America. She's had to do that exact same thing. She had to make that brave step of being the first to do something where it's uncommon. So there would have been so much heartbreak around rocking up to these events as a young kid and probably not feeling like you belong there. And that's just the sense of looking around when you just don't feel like, wow, well, there's no one that really looks like me that plays this game. But as I said, when you go to a rugby league or a rugby union game, man, you're running into cousins left, right and centre that you didn't even know you had. So it's, it was her just speaking out that way. But I'm really, really glad that she did, because there is genuinely some young up-and-coming tennis players. There's a young Tongan girl that I can think of. Her name's Tish Filitonga. She's only 13 or 14. She's playing tennis. You know, she's here in Western Sydney playing tennis, and she's gone to a few circuits now in Fiji, in the Solomon Islands. And she was saying if it wasn't for someone like Destiny, she probably wouldn't have pursued it like a, you know, genuine opportunity to pursue it as a career.
Do you think, like you say, Destiny has called out this misogynistic and racist culture in tennis? Do you think it'll prompt any introspection in the tennis world?
Well, I hope it does create some conversations, because it's drawn a lot of attention. Sometimes people in some of the industries only know what they know, and all it takes is a conversation and actually picking up the phone, calling Destiny. How can we solve this? How do we not let this happen again? Because, again, when I look at Destiny's situation, I don't look at her as an athlete at all. Like, I look at her as a, you know, someone where I've got a teenage daughter, you know, who's Tongan. My wife's Tongan. I've got nieces and nephews who are Tongan that, you know, want to try do certain things. It's a challenging world at the moment. It's different to when we grew up. And you just want to make sure that you have really good, honest conversations that actually lead to really good actions and positive outcomes so people don't have to go through this again.
And like you say, inspiring while playing tennis, but then inspiring as well in the way that she's been able to hold herself in her decision to leave tennis, despite it being obviously a terrible circumstance. Sam, thank you so much for joining me this morning and chatting about it.
No worries at all. Thanks for having me.
That was the ABC's Nisian Footy and Fresh Off the Field presenter, Sam Wykes. Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat this morning. Thank you so very much for your company. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. But stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daly.